You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Plus Daily Nonpareil for April 24th. I'm Tom from Drake University. Here's our first story. Area middle schoolers recognized during events, courtesy of Andrew Smith of the Council Plus Daily Nonpareil. The Lois Hills branch of the American Association of University Women brought more than 100 people together to put Girl Power on Display event at Iowa Western Community College. In an almost two-hour-long event, 10 girls from 10 schools were honored for their unique stories of perseverance and were gifted goodies, $50 and a framed certificate for their achievement. Keynote speakers Geraldine Turek and Maria Torres shared personal examples of perseverance in their lives, with both facing challenges in the process of immigrating to America and Council Bluffs. Turek left family in Madrid to live in Council Bluffs with her husband Josh, who represents the area in the Iowa House, while continuing to study dental hygiene at Iowa Western. Geraldine Turek initially faced depression and felt a lack of safety in a new land before applying to college and graduating with her degree. Torres, a graduate of Thomas Jefferson High School, shared her hardship of immigrating to the U.S. from El Salvador at age 10, after earthquakes in 2001 destroyed her family's home. Multiple failed attempts to migrate led to being detained in Mexico for 11 days. Her family made it to California, but the rent was too high. Then they moved to Alabama, where Torres first faced racism. Finally, they settled in Council Bluffs. "Here I am. I remember what it was like the first year, the hardest year of my life. I always said that once I turned 18, I'm going to come back home, I'm going to make money, I'm going to return it back to where I came from," Torres said. "It's been 23 years, so you guys tell me how that works," she joked. Gregory Sanford, organizer of Girl Power on Display, said the event was reimagined for its third year. "Initially, we talked about helping girls to see people who look like them, to encourage them to stay in school for the very best that they should be," Sanford said. "After the pandemic and taking another look at girls, we realized how much they have to persevere. So we decided, let's honor them for the perseverance that they've gone through." Members of the AAUW reached out to 9 schools in Pottawatomie County and one in Harrison County, asking school officials to recommend one girl who has pushed through challenges such as injuries, family issues, living transition, language barriers, or academic challenges. "Truly, we just want to make a difference," Sanford said. "We want everyone to know that they belong here, that we see them." Each girl that was honored walked up to accept the honorary gifts, and Sanford read their letters of recommendation aloud to the audience. "She helps everybody out," said Craig Foreman, grandfather and guardian of honoree Natalie Foreman. Irene Brooker was also honored with flowers for her 50 years of service with the AAUW, helping launch the Lois Hills branch, which is now in its 17th year. Organizers said that the event was made possible by a grant of AAUW of Iowa, the Beginnings Grant from the Iowa West Foundation, and a donation from a woman who displayed perseverance when young. Both sign language and Spanish interpreters were hired for the event. Our next story concerns Caitlin Clark. Clark plans to sign a new Nike deal valued at $28 million, courtesy of the Associated Press. Caitlin Clark appears to be on the cusp of setting another record. The most prolific scorer in NCAA Division I history and the number one overall pick in the WNBA draft will continue her association with Nike by signing a $28 million contract that spans 8 years and includes a signature shoe. The Wall Street Journal and The Athletic reported the pending deal, citing unnamed people familiar with the negotiations between the sportswear giant and Clark's agents. Excel Sports Management, which represents Clark, declined to comment. Nike did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Associated Press. Clark's initial name, image, and likeness deal, signed in 2022, expired at the end of the 2023-24 season. The new deal would be the richest sponsorship contract for a women's basketball player. Under Armour and Adidas also participated in contract discussions with Clark's team in February, according to the Wall Street Journal and The Athletic. Puma also showed some interest but walked away when told the bidding would start at $3 million a year, according to the Wall Street Journal. Clark received offers of $16 million over 4 years from Under Armour and $6 million over 4 years from Adidas, with both including a signature shoe, according to the Wall Street Journal. Clark earned about $3 million in NIL money at Iowa with deals she had with State Farm, Gatorade, and others, according to On3.com. Clark's agents were working on the new Nike contract even before she had announced she would turn pro, instead of return to Iowa for a fifth season under the COVID-19 exemption offered to players in college during the 2020 pandemic season. After averaging 31.6 points and leading the Hawkeyes to a second straight national championship game, Clark was drafted number one by the Indiana Fever on April 15th. She'll earn a $76,000 salary as a rookie. She's been the main driver for the dramatic uptick in women's basketball interest with her mix of deep three-point shots, flashy thread-the-needle passes, and overall court presence. A women's basketball record, 18.9 million viewers watched Iowa's loss to South Carolina in the NCAA title game, and a WNBA record, 2.45 million watched the draft. Of the Fever's 40 games this season, 36 will be nationally televised, and ticket sales have skyrocketed around the league. Her marketability is enhanced by her polished performances in media settings, and her surprise appearance on Saturday Night Live 2 weeks ago was widely acclaimed and exposed her to an even wider audience. The reported 8-year contract with Nike shows the sportswear giant's commitment. At 22, Clark could play well over a decade in the WNBA, and she could be on the U.S. roster for the Olympics in Paris this year, in Los Angeles in 2028, and Brisbane, Australia in 2032. Our next story. Prehistoric lake sturgeon is not endangered, U.S. says. Courtesy of Todd Richmond from the Associated Press. In Madison, Wisconsin, lake sturgeon don't need Endangered Species Act protections, federal wildlife officials announced, saying that stocking programs have helped the prehistoric fish return to areas where they had been vanished. The decision Monday ends the Arizona-based Center of Biological Diversity's petition filed in May 2018, asking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list lake sturgeon as endangered or threatened. Such listings would make harvesting the fish illegal, but without them, popular sturgeon harvest seasons in states such as Wisconsin and Michigan can continue. The center argued that over-harvesting and deteriorating habitat have severely depleted the species. Dams block access to spawning and rearing habitat, and water pollution and diversions have done irreparable harm, the center said. This is a disappointing decision because though some populations are well managed, overall the lake sturgeon has suffered a drastic decline, said Tierra Curry, a senior scientist at the center. Endangered Species Act protection would bring a comprehensive recovery plan and ongoing funding to restore these iconic fish across their former range. Chuck Traxler, the Wildlife Service's Midwest Deputy Regional Director, said stocking has helped grow adult lake sturgeon populations and increase spawning, agency officials said. Putting the creatures on the list would be like going to the emergency room, and the rebounding of species doesn't need that level of protection, he said. It doesn't mean everything is good right now, he said. It means keep up the good work. Populations aren't at historical highs, the agency acknowledged in a December state assessment, but stocking returned them to the Red River of the North between Minnesota and North Dakota, the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers, parts of the Mississippi River, and the Coosa River. Dam removals and habitat restoration efforts have also helped, the agency said, citing work in 2015 to retrofit a dam in Wisconsin's Menominee River to allow spawning sturgeon to travel upstream and the removal of the Brecksville Dam on Ohio's Cuyahoga River in 2020. The agency also pointed to reef restoration work in the corridor connecting Lake Huron and Lake Erie that has created a place for sturgeon to lay eggs and noted that 9 of 43 toxic spots along Great Lake shorelines have been cleaned up. The assessment also noted the adaptable species should be able to withstand warmer water due to climate change. Lake sturgeon are ancient North American freshwater fish. They're essentially living fossils, first appearing about 136 million years ago when dinosaurs ruled the planet. They resemble torpedoes, with dorsal ridges and snouts. They can grow up to 7 feet long and weigh up to 300 pounds. Males typically live about 50 years. Females live between 80 and 150 years. They're found in the upper and lower Mississippi River Basin, as well as the Great Lakes. Commercial anglers considered lake sturgeon a nuisance because it tore their nets, leading to widespread overharvesting in the 1800s that continued into the 20th century. Lake sturgeon can't reproduce fast enough to replace the losses. It takes up to 3 decades before they reach spawning age, and even then they don't spawn annually. And many don't survive to the trip back to their birth waters to spawn.
The Wildlife Service has compared lake sturgeon losses to the mass destruction of the American buffalo. 20 states have outlawed sturgeon harvesting. 14 of those states have listed lake sturgeon as threatened or endangered. Volunteers and Wisconsin Natural Resources officials have been guarding spawning sturgeon from poachers on the Wolf River for 30 years. Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin still hold hook-and-line lake sturgeon fishing seasons. Michigan and Wisconsin hold sturgeon spearing seasons each winter as well, where anglers drill holes through lake ice and impale sturgeon as they swim past. The Wisconsin Natural Resources Department reported 432 sturgeon were taken in February, down from 1,405 in 2023. Warm weather and poor ice conditions led to the diminished return, according to the department. Michigan officials set the total harvest limit at just 6 sturgeon, but ended up canceling due to warm weather and unsafe ice conditions. Those state seasons are so tightly regulated that the harvest don't impact the species overall, said Lori Nordstrom, the Wildlife Service's Midwest Assistant Regional Director of Ecological Services. Michigan and Wisconsin, for example, allow an angler to take only 1 sturgeon per year. Minnesota anglers must release any sturgeon they catch in inland waters. Wisconsin regulations are designed to keep the harvest rate below 5%, with all tag fees going to the state's Sturgeon Conservation Program, according to the Wildlife Service. Leaders of Sturgeon for Tomorrow, a nonprofit organization that works to rehabilitate sturgeon in Wisconsin and Michigan and supports harvesting the fish, praised the Wildlife Service's decision Monday. They said the ruling enables the states to continue managing sturgeon and allows harvesting to continue, which in turn helps researchers learn more about the ancient creatures. "We're very happy with it," said Jim Pat, president of the Southwest chapter of Sturgeon for Tomorrow, one of 5 chapters along the Lake Winnebago system, which hosts Wisconsin's spearing season. "This is a big thing. We can keep our research going and keep our population strong and continue what we've been doing." Our next story. Woman charged with murder in deadly Michigan party crash. A Michigan woman was arraigned on second-degree murder and other charges Tuesday after prosecutors say she drunkenly crashed her SUV into a boat club that was hosting a child's birthday party, killing a young brother and sister and injuring several other people. Marcella Chidester, 66, did not enter a plea to the 8 counts she faces in Saturday's crash at the Swan Boat Club in Monroe County, about 30 miles south of Detroit. During a court hearing that was live-streamed, Chidester's right arm was in a cast just above the elbow to her fingers. She has been sent to jail since the crash, and the judge set her bond at the $1.5 million prosecutors requested after relatives of some of the victims asked him to set it at that level. In arguing for the $1.5 million bond, prosecutor Jeff Yorkie told the court that Chidester had substance abuse issues that were corroborated by her friends and family. Defense attorney Bill Colovos asked the judge to set Chidester's bond at $100,000. He said she only had a glass of wine and a bowl of chili 4 hours before the crash, and she suffered since November with epileptic-type seizures in her legs. "This is not a monster," Colovos said. "It's horrible what happened, but there are some things we don't have control over." Colovos said that prior to Saturday's crash, Chidester had no traffic tickets or police record. Yorkie responded that there were no indication that Chidester suffered a seizure before the crash, and testing showed her blood alcohol level was significantly over the legal limit. If Chidester posts bond, will be required to forfeit her passport, have no alcohol, wear a tether, and cannot drive. A probable cause conference was scheduled for April 30th, followed by a May 6th preliminary examination. Chidester is a former Commodore at the boat club, the Detroit News reported. The crash killed 8-year-old Alana Phillips and her 4-year-old brother Zane Phillips, the sheriff's office said. Their mother, Mariah Dodds, and another sibling were among the injured. The party was for the 3-year-old of Dodds' friend, according to a Detroit law firm representing Dodds' family in a lawsuit against Chidester and the tavern where she reportedly was before the crash. Dodds suffered broken ribs, a collapsed lung, cuts, and bruises, according to the law firm. Her surviving son suffered broken legs, broken ribs, and a fractured skull. Raquel Smothers told the court she was at the party and witnessed the deaths of her nephew and niece. "They were sitting at that table eating, and this woman crashed her car through this building, destroying all of our lives," a nearly inconsolable Smothers said. "Nobody should ever have to go to a birthday party thinking that they're going to die." Our next story is about the Trump hush money criminal trial. Tabloid chief testifies. publisher promised to suppress negative stories in 2016 race. Courtesy of Michael R. Sizaks, Jennifer Peltz, Eric Tucker, and Jake Offenhartz of the Associated Press. From New York, a veteran tabloid publisher testified Tuesday that he has pledged to be Donald Trump's eyes and ears during his 2016 presidential campaign, recounting how he promised the then-candidate how he would help suppress harmful stories and even arranged to purchase a doorman's silence. The testimony from David Pecker was designed to bolster prosecutors' assertions of a decades-long friendship between Trump and the former publisher of the National Enquirer, that culminated in an agreement to give the candidate's lawyer a heads-up on negative tips and stories so they could be quashed. Pecker is the first witness in Trump's history-making hush money trial in Manhattan, where he faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with payments meant to prevent harmful stories from surfacing during the 2016 campaign. Testimony resumes Thursday. The effort to suppress unflattering information was designed to illegally influence the election. Prosecutors allege in seeking to elevate the gravity of the first trial of a former American president and the first of four criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. Pecker detailed his involvement in Trump's rise from political novice to the Republican nomination and then the White House. He explained how he and the National Enquirer parlayed rumor-mongering into splashy tabloid stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress seamy stories about Trump, including a porn actor's claim of extramarital sexual encounter a decade earlier. Pecker traced the origins to their relationship to a 1980s meeting at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida. Their ties were solidified during a pivotal August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower involving Trump, his lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen, and another aide, Hope Hicks, in which Pecker was asked what he could do for the campaign. Pecker said he volunteered to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. He also said that he also told Trump, "I will be your eyes and ears." "I said that anything I hear in the marketplace, if I hear anything negative about yourself, or if I hear about women selling stories, I would notify Michael Cohen, so that the rights could be purchased and the stories could be killed." Pecker painted Cohen as a shadow editor of the National Enquirer's pro-Trump coverage, directing the tabloid to go after whichever Republican candidates were gaining in momentum. Our next story concerns protests continuing at campuses. Police arrest dozens across U.S. who object to Israel's war in Gaza. The main picture specifies students protest Tuesday at an encampment outside the Cressage Auditorium on the campus of MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What shows is a significant amount of tents outside of an arch-shaped auditorium with Palestinian flags and a sign that reads MIT out of Palestine and Free Palestine sign. Courtesy of Karen Matthews and Nick Perry of the Associated Press from New York. What began last week when Columbia University students refused to end their protests against Israel's war with Hamas turned into a much larger movement by Tuesday as students across the U.S. set up encampments, occupied buildings, and ignored demands to leave. Protests bubbled for months but kicked into a higher gear after more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who camped out on Columbia's Upper Manhattan campus were arrested Thursday. Dozens more protesters were arrested at other campuses since, and many now face charges of trespassing or disorderly conduct. With tensions at Columbia continuing to run high and some students afraid to set foot on the campus, officials said the Ivy League school will switch to hybrid learning for the rest of the semester, which will be finished by the end of next week. At NYU, police said 133 protesters were taken into custody late Monday, and all were released with summons to appear in court on disorderly conduct charges. NYC Mayor Eric Adams said police officials were hit with bottles and other objects at some of the protests. In Connecticut, police arrested 60 protesters, including 47 students, Monday at Yale University after they refused to leave an encampment in a campus plaza. In the Midwest on Tuesday, a demonstration at the center of the University of Michigan campus grew to nearly 40 tents, and police arrested 9 anti-war protesters at the University of Minnesota after taking down an encampment in front of the library. Hundreds later rallied to the Minnesota campus to demand their release. On the West Coast, California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, announced its campus would be closed throughout Wednesday after demonstrators occupied a building Monday night. 3 protesters were arrested. Classes were to be conducted remotely, the school said on its website. Campus protests began after the Hamas Israel-led October 7th attack on Israel, which left about 1,200 people dead. Militants took about 250 hostages. During the ensuing war, Israel has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians in Gaza, according to the health ministry there. The New York Civil Liberties Union on Tuesday cautioned universities against being too quick to call in law enforcement. As for our next story, feds settle for $138.7 million for a botched investigation. Sports doctor sexually assaulted gymnast for years before arrest. Courtesy of the Associated Press in Detroit, the U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016, a critical time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on his victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of treatment for sports injuries. Nassar worked at Michigan State University and also served as a team doctor at Indianapolis-based USA Gymnastics. He's now serving decades in prison for assaulting female athletes. Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Meiser said Nassar betrayed the trust of those in his care for decades, and that allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset. For more than a year, FBI agents in Indianapolis and Los Angeles had knowledge of allegations against him, but apparently took no action, an internal investigation found. Our next story, Senate okays aid package for Ukraine and other allies. Biden expected to sign legislation that includes a potential TikTok ban. Chrissy, the Associated Press of Washington. The Senate passed $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending the legislation to President Joe Biden after months of delays and contentious debate over how involved the United States should be in foreign wars. The Senate passed the bill on an overwhelming 79-18 vote late Tuesday after the House approved the package Saturday. Biden, who worked with congressional leaders to win support, is expected to quickly sign the legislation and start the process of sending weapons to Ukraine, which has been struggling to hold its front lines against Russia. The legislation would also send $26 billion in wartime assistance to Israel and humanitarian relief to Gaza, and $8 billion to counter Chinese threats in Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. The $61 billion for Ukraine comes as the war-torn country desperately needs new firepower. U.S. officials said the Pentagon was preparing about $1 billion of the aid to be on its way shortly. The legislation would also force TikTok's China-based parent company to sell the social media platform under the threat of a ban, a contentious move that's expected to face legal challenges. Our next story, about the Paris Olympics. Mayor confident water quality will allow for swimming, courtesy of Sylvie Corbet of the Associated Press. From Paris, Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo said she was confident water quality in the River Seine will be up to Olympic standards this summer, and that she'll be able to prove it by swimming there, possibly alongside President Emmanuel Macron. The Seine is the venue for marathon swimming at the Games and the swimming leg of the Olympic and Paralympic triathlons. Asked Tuesday about whether she'll meet the promise to swim in the Seine before the Games, Hidalgo said, "For sure, because the water quality will be good." For decades, the Seine was too toxic for most fish and for swimmers, useful mainly as a waterway to transport goods and people, or as a water grave for discarded bicycles and other trash. Swimming in the Seine has, with some exceptions, been illegal since 1923. Hidalgo mentioned new facilities that have been specifically built to clean up the river, whose water quality was recently denounced by an environmental group. A water treatment plant in Champigny-sur-Marne, east of Paris, was inaugurated Tuesday. Next week, we'll see the official opening of a huge storage basin meant to reduce the need to spill bacteria-laden wastewater untreated when it rains. The giant hole dug next to Paris' Austerlitz train station will hold the equivalent to 20 Olympic swimming pools of dirty water that will be treated rather than being spat raw into the river. Hidalgo said she invited top officials to swim at the Seine in an event dubbed the Big Dive to be staged at the end of June or beginning of July. Macron, who himself promised to swim in the river, has been invited, she confirmed, as well as Paris Olympic organizer and IOC President Thomas Bach. Our next story concerns the NFL. New faces, exciting times. Carolina quarterback Young encouraged by off-season changes. courtesy of Steve Reed of the Associated Press. From Charlotte, North Carolina, the Carolina Panthers spent more than $150 million upgrading their offensive line and traded for wide receiver Diontae Johnson in an attempt to help quarterback Bryce Young maximize his potential. Whether or not that takes Young a much-needed step forward after going 2-14 as a rookie starter in 2023 remains to be seen. But the second-year quarterback appeared pretty excited on Tuesday about the organizational changes this offseason, following the first practice under new head coach Dave Canales. "It's just great to get some new faces in there," Young said after the first day of minicamp. "They were all hungry and great players. There's a lot of new ideas, new energy, and new people. Right now, the mission is just for all of that to come together, and for us to get on the same page and focus in on turning this into a winning football team." The Panthers invested a lot in Young last year, and it's absolutely vital to their future that he shows progression. Carolina sent 4 draft picks and wide receiver DJ Moore to the Chicago Bears to move up to the number one spot in the draft last year to get Young, who won the 2021 Heisman Trophy at Alabama. It's a move that ultimately cost Carolina the number one overall pick in this week's NFL draft over the Panthers, finished 2-15, the worst record in the league. Carolina does not have a first-round pick on Thursday night. Young's struggles in Carolina were only amplified by the success of C.J. Stroud, who was drafted one spot behind Young by the Houston Texans. Young averaged just 180 yards passing per game with 11 touchdowns and 10 interceptions. It didn't help that he spent most of the season under duress, sacked 62 times, second most in the league. Young refused to say if constant pressure impacted his confidence, choosing to talk only about the future. But new general manager Dan Morgan certainly felt the need to shore up the middle of the offensive line, signing guards Robert Hunt from the Dolphins to a 5-year, $100 million deal and Damian Lewis from the Seahawks to a 4-year, $53 million contract. "I have that inside-out mentality," Canales said. "It starts up front. I've always believed that about football. It starts on the offensive line and defensive line. Getting those critical pieces, those were the first moves we made in free agency." Morgan also wanted more playmakers in the passing game, trading for Johnson. He would be paired with a reliable veteran wideout Adam Thielen and last year's second-round pick Jonathan Mingo. Johnson caught just 51 passes for 717 yards and 5 touchdowns last season for the Pittsburgh Steelers. But he's shown big-time star potential with 107 receptions for 1,161 yards and 8 touchdowns in 2021. Johnson said he's a player who can get open no matter where he is on the field. He said Tuesday that Canales has told him he will be the first option on most of Young's reads, a strong indication the Panthers view him as their number one receiver. "I'm here to make him better as a quarterback and to help him grow," Johnson said. Briefly, regarding a couple other NFL teams, for the Bears, general manager Ryan Poles wasn't quite ready to announce that Chicago would take Caleb Williams with the number one pick in the NFL draft on Tuesday. He said everyone will have to tune in Thursday to watch. Barring a massive surprise, the Bears will kick off the draft by grabbing the 2022 Heisman Trophy winner and setting themselves on a course they hope takes them to the top of the NFL. For the Rams, quarterback Stetson Bennett has rejoined Los Angeles for the start of its offseason program after missing his entire rookie season for undisclosed reasons. Bennett is attending team meetings and lifting weights with his teammates at the Rams training complex, coach Sean McVay confirmed. For the Eagles, the NFL has reinstated Philadelphia cornerback Isaiah Rodgers after a year-long suspension for violating the league's gambling policy. The league said Tuesday that Rodgers has been cleared to participate in team activities effective immediately.
You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Tom from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-683.
As for our next story, now ahead concerns the NBA. McDaniels helps Timberwolves take 2-0 series lead over the Suns. From Minneapolis, Jaden McDaniels scored 25 points for a career best in the playoffs and spearheaded another stifling defensive performance by the Minnesota Timberwolves in a 105-93 victory over the Phoenix Suns, to take a 2-0 lead in their first-round Western Conference playoff series on Tuesday night. Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert each added 18 points to help the Timberwolves offset the smothering of Anthony Edwards by the Suns, who held the All-Star to 15 points after allowing him 33 in the opener. Edwards went 3-for-12 from the floor. The teams head to Phoenix for Game 3 on Friday night. Minnesota has held a 2-0 series lead only one other time in franchise history, against Denver in the first round in 2004 en route to a 4-1 series victory. Devin Booker scored 20 points, Kevin Durant added 18, and six-man Eric Gordon had 15 for the Suns, who again failed to get their high-octane offense in gear. The big three of Booker, Durant, and Bradley Beal combined to shoot 18-for-45, with McDaniels leading the list of reasons for the slump. Phoenix lost starting guard Grayson Allen to an aggravated ankle sprain in the third quarter. Mavericks 96, Clippers 93. Luka Doncic scored 32 points, and Dallas overcame the return of Clippers superstar Kawhi Leonard to beat Los Angeles on the road and tie their Western Conference first-round playoff series at a game apiece. Leonard had 15 points and 7 rebounds in 35 minutes of his first game since March 31st. He hasn't played or had any contact practices cut during that stretch because of inflammation in his surgically repaired right knee. Kyrie Irving added 23 points for the Mavs. In the Eastern Conference, Pacers 125, Bucks 108. Pascal Siakam scored 37 points, and Indiana overcame another fantastic first-half performance from Damian Lillard to beat host Milwaukee and tie its first-round playoff series. The Pacers snapped a 10-game playoff losing streak that began with a Game 7 loss to Cleveland in a first-round series in 2018. The Pacers were swept by Boston in 2019 and by Miami in 2020. Two nights after scoring all 35 of his points in the first half of the Bucks' 109-94 Game 1 victory, Lillard had 26 by halftime Tuesday and finished with 34. It wasn't enough. Lillard didn't get enough help, with the Bucks once again missing two-time MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo due to a strained left calf. Around the league, Celtics and the Thunder expect adjustments. The top two seeds in each conference had very different outings in their playoff openers. In the East, the Boston Celtics mostly rolled through a Miami Heat team missing Jimmy Butler. In the West, the Oklahoma City Thunder needed a big game from MVP finalist Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to fend off the New Orleans Pelicans for their first home playoff victory since 2019. Both top seeds expect to see adjustments from their opponents in Game 2. Miami will seek to address the three-point shooting disparity Boston had in Game 1. Oklahoma City will be looking to generate more offense from a roster that had been seven players participating in their first playoff game. Maxey named Most Improved Player. Tyrese Maxey was sixth in the Most Improved Player voting 2 years ago, a tribute to the jump he made between his first and second seasons in the NBA. Voters thought the jump he made from his third year to his fourth was more impressive. Philadelphia's All-Star guard was named the league's Most Improved Season on Tuesday night. Maxey finished the regular season averaging 25.9 points, 6.2 assists, 3.7 rebounds, and 1 steal per game, all career best. Briefly, regarding the Timberwolves, Minnesota's ownership dispute is moving into mediation, the first session towards determining whether Glenn Taylor will remain controlling owner or cede to Mark Lohr and Alex Rodriguez has been scheduled for May 1st, according to an AP source. On a lighter note, our next story is a little bit more humorous. Rub-a-dub-dub, No Men in the Tub, by Jerry Zazima of the Tribune News Service. I haven't taken a bath since the Johnson administration. Lyndon, not Andrew. And it looks like the drought will continue because boys aren't allowed in our newly renovated bathroom. That is the edict handed down by our three granddaughters, ages 11, 7, and 4. Even before the renovation began, they taped a sign to the door reading, "Girls only, no boys allowed." Yes, I know the word girls should be plural, not possessive, but you must understand that these girls are A, young, and B, very possessive of the bathroom when they visit our house. They have an ally in their grandmother, my wife Sue, a girl who doubled down on the order when she told me, the only boy on the premises, that the bathroom was hers. Sue doesn't mind sharing it with our granddaughters, who love to splash in the tub, but the rest of the time she wants the place to herself. I don't blame her. For the first 11 years of our marriage, we lived in an apartment with only one bathroom. Soon our two then young daughters, now the mothers of our granddaughters, complained that I took too much time doing important manly things like trimming my nose hairs and cutting myself into ribbons while shaving. When we moved into a condo, the situation was somewhat better, but we were still in each other's way when it came to personal hygiene and answering the call of nature. For the past quarter of a century, Sue and I have lived in a house with 2.5 bathrooms. We have shared the main bathroom, which has a shower but no bathtub. The other full bathroom, which is larger than ours, has a shower and tub and was recently renovated. It was seldom used, except when our granddaughters came over to put on makeup, frost cupcakes, play outside, and wash everything off in the bath. This got me thinking. It would be nice, too, after all these years, to take a bath, too. I typically take showers that use enough water to drown a walrus. But now that we have a brand new tub, I have been tempted to pamper myself by soaking in a warm, relaxing bubble bath. I remember the old TV commercial for Calgon Bath and Beauty Products. A woman was in the tub, strategically covered by bubbles, smiling contentedly and screaming, "Calgon, take me away." I can envision myself in a new commercial, up to my neck in soothing water and strategically covered in bubbles, which would be appropriate since I am a bubblehead. I would also be playing with my granddaughter's bath toys, which include a couple of rubber duckies. "Quack, quack," I would exclaim, to which I would add, "Calgon, take me away." If that ever happened, Sue would call the authorities to have me taken away. Then she would have both full bathrooms to herself. But after so many years, it's natural for spouses to want their own space. Even the most loving couples, as we are, need a little privacy. That is why I am staking a claim to the main bathroom, which was renovated last year. I won't go so far as to tape a sign to the door reading, "Boys only, no girls allowed." But I do think I deserve a sanctuary where I can trim my nose hairs, take marathon showers, and bleed profusely while shaving. The problem is that Sue hasn't fully moved into her own bathroom yet, so we are still sharing the main bathroom. That's all right with me, because I'm not a selfish guy, so I don't mind it when I'm brushing my teeth and Sue wants to do the same. I simply smile, which causes toothpaste to drip out of my mouth, and move over. But I am sometimes tempted, when nobody's around, to stand in the shower and exclaim, "Calgon, take me away!" Our next story is on nutrition. Questions on blood type diet and peanuts. A college student in Illinois writes, "I've always been interested in nutrition, and one of the things I see popping up all the time is something called the blood type diet. I know that losing weight has nothing to do with your blood type, but there's another part of this diet regarding lectins that I've always wondered about. The author of this book claims that if we eat foods that are wrong for our blood type, these lectins cause clumping of our red blood cells. This supposedly leads to disease and illness later in life. Numerous foods are claimed to be healthy for people with certain blood types and bad for other blood types. Some of my favorite foods are supposedly bad for me because I am blood type A. I love tomatoes, cashews, avocados, mangoes, coconut, and yogurt. But according to the blood type, they are all bad for me and can cause agglutination, which leads to possible disease and illness. Maybe you can debunk this or point me in the right direction to somebody who can explain this. Grant L." I appreciate your confusion, Grant. This diet was popularized back in 1996 with a book called Eat Right for Your Type by neuropathic physician Dr. Peter D'Amo. D'Amo states that if you eat lectins that are not compatible with your blood type, you can experience serious health effects. Trouble is, there are no valid studies to prove this hypothesis. One study in 2013 searched all the available evidence and found no particular benefit. Another study in 2014 reported that any health effects seen with these diets was not related to the blood type. Lectins are real, however, and some can be toxic, such as those found in raw legumes such as beans, lentils, peas, soybeans, and peanuts. But who wants to eat raw beans anyways? Boiling them in water deactivates these proteins. Here's another twist. Some lectins are actually being studied for their ability to kill off dangerous viruses and fight disease. My advice for you, unless you have another reason to avoid the foods you love, I wouldn't base my choices on blood type. John M. in Lynchburg, Virginia asks, "A recent column mentioned the benefits of many foods, including nuts. My question concerns peanuts. I understand peanuts are not from a tree, but grow on the ground. We normally have them in front of our house. Do these provide any of the benefits of tree nuts? Or were they called peanuts to eliminate the rather backwards sound of goober peas?" You're right, John. Despite their name, peanuts are legumes, not nuts. They're higher in protein than tree nuts and do provide similar health benefits. And according to the Peanut Institute, 98 to 100% of lectins will be destroyed by boiling or roasting. I'll save goober peas for another column. Now for some smaller bites of stories with the digest. New U.S. rule would ban non-compete measures. From Washington, U.S. companies would no longer be able to bar employees from taking jobs with competitors under a rule approved by a federal agency. The FTC voted 3-2 Tuesday to ban measures known as non-compete agreements, which bar workers from jumping to or starting competing companies for a prescribed period of time. According to the FTC, 30 million people, roughly 1 in 5 workers, are subject to such restrictions. The rule, which doesn't apply to workers at nonprofits, is to take effect in 4 months unless it is blocked by legal challenges. The Biden administration took aim at non-compete measures, which are associated with executives at technology and financial companies, but also ensnare lower-paid workers. A 2021 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis found more than 1 in 10 workers who earn $20 or less an hour are covered by non-compete agreements. Labor Department expands overtime pay eligibility. From New York, the Biden administration finalized a new rule that's set to make millions of more salaried workers eligible for overtime pay in the U.S. It's the largest expansion in federal overtime eligibility in decades. Starting July 1st, employers will be required to pay overtime to salaried workers who make less than $43,888 a year in certain executive, administrative, and professional roles, the Labor Department said Tuesday. That cap will rise to $58,656 by the start of 2025. The current overtime eligibility threshold of $35,568 was set under the Trump administration in 2019, 3 years after a more generous Obama-era effort ultimately was scuttled in court after pushback from some business leaders and Republican politicians. For some briefs, for the Capitol riots, David Joseph Gietzen, 31, of Sanford, North Carolina, who became a fugitive after a federal jury convicted him of assaulting a police officer during the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot, was sentenced Tuesday to 6 years in prison. For labor, the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday appeared likely to side with Starbucks in a case that could make it harder for the federal government to seek injunctions when it suspects a company of interfering in unionization campaigns. Former Republican U.S. Representative George Santos of New York said Tuesday he will drop his long-shot bid to return to Congress after his campaign committee reported no fundraising or expenditures in March. He was expelled from the House months ago while facing federal fraud charges. The U.N. called Tuesday for a clear, transparent, and credible investigation of mass graves uncovered at two major hospitals in war-torn Gaza that were raided by Israeli troops. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich will remain jailed on espionage charges until at least late June, after a Moscow court rejected his appeal Tuesday that sought to end his pretrial detention. The FDA said Tuesday that samples of pasteurized milk tested positive for remnants of the bird flu virus that infected dairy cows, but stressed that the material is inactivated and doesn't pose a risk. Officials said they continue to study the issue. Today in history, courtesy of the Associated Press. Today's highlight. On April 24th, 1995, the final bomb linked to the Unabomber exploded inside the Sacramento, California offices of a lobbying group for the wood products industry, killing chief lobbyist Gilbert B. Murray. Theodore Kaczynski was later sentenced to 4 lifetimes in prison for a series of bombings that killed 3 people and injured 29 others. On this date, in 1877, federal troops were ordered out of New Orleans, ending the North's post-Civil War rule in the South. In 1915, in what's considered the start of the Armenian Genocide, the Ottoman Empire began rounding up Armenian political and cultural leaders in Constantinople. In 1960, rioting erupted in Biloxi, Mississippi, after black protesters staged a wade-in at a whites-only beach were attacked by a crowd of hostile white people. In 1961, in the wake of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, the White House issued a statement saying that President John F. Kennedy bears sole responsibility for the events of the past few days. In 1962, MIT achieved the first satellite relay of a television signal between Camp Parks, California, and Westford, Massachusetts. In 1967, Soviet cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov was killed when his Soyuz-1 spacecraft crashed after his parachutes failed to deploy properly during re-entry. He was the first human spaceflight fatality. In 1980, the U.S. launched an unsuccessful attempt to free the American hostages in Iran, a mission that resulted in the deaths of 8 U.S. servicemen. In 1990, the space shuttle Discovery blasted off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, carrying the $1.5 billion Hubble Space Telescope. In 2005, Pope Benedict XVI formally began his stewardship for the Roman Catholic Church. The former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger said in his installation homily that as pontiff, he would listen to the will of God in governing the world's 1.1 billion Catholics. In 2013, in Bangladesh, a shoddily constructed 8-story commercial building housing garment factories collapsed, killing more than 1,100 people. In 2018, former police officer Joseph D'Angelo was arrested at his home near Sacramento, California, after DNA linked him to crimes attributed to the Golden State Killer. Authorities believed he committed 13 murders and more than 50 rapes in the 1970s and 1980s. D'Angelo pleaded guilty in 2020 to 13 counts of murder and was sentenced to life in prison without a parole. Transgender policies diverse. Some major faiths, religions remain more welcoming than others. Courtesy of Deepa Barath, David Crary, and Mariam Pham of the Associated Press. The Vatican recently issued a new document rejecting the concept of changing one's biological sex, a setback for transgender people who hope Pope Francis might be setting the stage for a more welcoming approach from the Catholic Church. Major religions have diverse approaches to gender identity and transgender people. For Christianity, the Catholic Church's disapproving stance towards gender transition is shared by some other denominations. For example, the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., adopted a resolution in 2014 stating that God's design was the creation of two distinct and complementary sexes, male and female. It asserts that gender identity is determined by biological sex, not by one's self-perception. However, numerous mainline Protestant denominations welcome trans people. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America elected an openly transgender man as bishop in 2021. In Islam, policies can vary in different regions. Abbas Shuman, Secretary General of Al-Azhar's Council of Senior Scholars in Cairo, said, "For us, sex conversion is completely rejected. It is God who has determined the sex of the fetus, and intervening to change that is a change of God's creation, which is completely rejected," Shuman added. In Israel, the Shiite theocracy's founder, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, issued a religious decree, or fatwa, decades ago that opened the way for official support for gender transition surgery. In Hinduism, Hinduist society in South Asia, while traditional rules were and still are prescribed for men and women, people of non-binary gender expression have been recognized for millennia and played important roles in holy texts. Many third-gender people rose to significant positions of power under Hindu and Muslim rulers. One survey in 2014 estimated about 3 million third-gender people live in India alone. Sanskrit, the ancient language of Hindu scriptures, has the vocabulary to describe three genders: masculine, feminine, and gender neutral. The most common group of third-gender people in India are known as the Hijras. While some choose to undergo gender reassignment surgery, others are born intersex. Most consider themselves neither male or female. Some Hindus believe third-gender people have special powers and the ability to bless or curse, which has led to stereotyping causing the community to be feared and marginalized. Many live in poverty without proper access to healthcare, housing, and employment. In 2014, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh, which is a Muslim-majority country, officially recognized third-gender people as citizens deserving of equal rights. The Supreme Court of India stated, "Is the right of every human being to choose their gender, and recognition of the group is not a social or medical issue, but a human rights issue." For Buddhism, they traditionally adhere to binary gender roles, particularly in its monastic traditions where men and women are segregated and assigned specific roles. These beliefs remain strong in the Theravada tradition, as seen in the attempt of the Thai Sangha Council, the governing Buddhist body in Thailand, to ban ordinations of transgender people. More recently, the Theravada tradition somewhat eased restrictions against gender non-conformed people by ordaining them in their sex recorded at birth. However, the Mahayana and Vajrayana schools of Buddhism allow more exceptions, while the Jodo Shinshu sect has been even more inclusive in ordaining transgender monks in both in Japan and North America. In Tibetan Buddhism, Taishi Chodokdup, an openly queer monk, was ordained after their teacher refrained from prescribing about their gender identity as prescribed by Buddhist doctrine. Many Buddhist denominations, particularly in the West, are intentionally inclusive of transgender people. For Judaism, Reform Judaism is accepting of transgender people and allows for the ordination of trans rabbis. According to David J. Meyer, who was a rabbi in Marblehead, Massachusetts for many years, Jewish traditional wisdom allowed possibilities of gender identity and expression that differed from those typically associated with the sex assigned at birth. Our mystical texts, the Kabbalah, address the notion of transitioning from one gender to another, he wrote on a Reform-affiliated website. It's different, for the most part, in Orthodox Judaism. Most transgender people will find Orthodox communities extremely difficult to navigate, says the Human Rights Campaign, a U.S. LGBTQ rights advocacy group. Transgender people are further constrained by Orthodox Judaism's emphasis on binary gender and strict separation between men and women, HRC says. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 24th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Tom from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.